focus on the idea of failed states. Now, what is a failed state? A failed state basically is a state that is unable to provide the basic infrastructure needed for people to be able to live good lives and to attain a level of adequate level of well-being. And in extreme form, of course, failed states are unable to provide basic security. So peace and security cannot be relied upon, and that's why there's a connection between conflict and failed states. But the concept is broader than that, and there are a variety of definitions. I won't get into too many details about that, but I think we know that Sweden is not a failed state, and Somalia is. And I think in between, there can be a lot of discussion. But as I'll say, as I'll point out, the details really of the concept are less important than the bigger picture. And what I want to focus on is the connection between failed states and the well-being of people everywhere in the world. So we're used to thinking about failed states and the people, of course, who live in those states and are affected by state failure. Also, bad neighborhoods. The regional problems are huge. When you look at a place like Africa, over 50 countries, it's a very fragmented continent, and all you need to have is one bad neighbor, and it's very difficult for neighbors to be able to provide basic development. But I want to look at the connection between failed states and global health. Global health. Okay, and so I'm looking at extreme situations. There's a failed states index that's been worked up by people at Foreign Policy Magazine and an organization called the Fund for Peace. And I'm not recommending it, but it's one measure of what a failed state might be. And they're looking at different things: social indicators, economic indicators, political indicators. And I think if you look down this list, you'll see that it contains a lot of the things that we think of as being significant. Now, there are other measures that are used, and one is called, the World Bank has a group of governance measures, one of which is called the rule of law. Now, the rule of law is basically providing the most basic infrastructure needed for people to basically go about their lives in a kind of a private way. So you have basic peace and security are provided. There's a police force that is somewhat reliable in controlling crime and violence. You have basics in terms of an impartial judiciary, able to enforce contracts, that kind of thing. These are the things that actually an economist would say would be a precondition for effective development. And what's interesting is that there's a very, very strong correlation between the failed states index and the rule of law index from the World Bank. In fact, of all the indices that we've made comparisons to, these two are the most closely aligned. Now, the health data we don't have for 2006, so that's one reason why I'm moving from the rule of law to the 2004 data on health. But here you'll see some interesting things. There's virtually no correlation between the rule of law and conflict. And this is pointing out the problem that Cortland mentioned, that what do the measures of conflict really tell us that are important, particularly from the perspective of global health? There's also very little correlation between conflict and under 5 mortality. Now, conflict includes, for this measure, which I'm taking from an institute in Sweden, basically is indicating whether a country is at war. Well, the United States is at war today, so the United States would be a conflict country, but so would Somalia. Okay, so you're getting to see now why the correlation shows up as being so weak. On the other hand, the correlation between the rule of law and under 5 mortality is very strong. So basically, the kind of infrastructure that one relies upon, and I'm meaning infrastructure in terms of institutions rather than necessarily physical infrastructure, that is something that's very highly related to basic public health. Now, this gentleman, I don't know how famous he is. He should be very famous. His name is Ali Maumala, and he's the last person in the world to have endemic smallpox. And again, I want to make this connection between global health and failed states. It's important to know that Mr. Malin lived in Somalia and was affected in October 1977 when Somalia had a government. In 1991, that government fell in a coup, and of course, Somalia has been a state of failure, basically, ever since then. And it's actually interesting to speculate that this what most people would agree is probably the greatest achievement of public health ever, if that could be achieved today. So had we not eradicated smallpox in the 1970s, would it be possible to do so today? And I think there's a case that we made that we cannot. So in a sense, what we're seeing is that the world in some measures has actually slid back rather than moved forward. Now the similar effort that we're pushing for today is polio eradication. I'm focusing on eradication, of course, because it's a very extreme policy and it has the potential, anyway, of benefiting all countries. Smallpox eradication was an extraordinary benefit. It probably is the greatest achievement for international development ever. The benefit-cost ratio for smallpox eradication was in the neighborhood of about 450 to 1. And I don't know if you normally deal with these numbers, but a typical World Bank investment will have a small benefit-cost ratio of about 1.2. So when you get up to about 450, 480, this is a hell of an investment. Well, the world is now trying to eradicate polio. And if you look at the literature on polio, you'll see that there's been a great success, but the success has been in terms of control. So the number of cases of polio has fallen about 99%, which is great, except that to achieve eradication, you need as a first step to reduce the number of the incidence of polio to zero. And it's the last 1% that's the hardest, and that's where we are now. That's where we have been since about the year 2000. And as this quote here points out, many of these areas where polio remains are conflict zones. Now, today, polio is endemic or a big problem in a few areas. I'll point out three that are particularly important. One is the border area between Afghanistan and Pakistan, where recently, this is an area that is controlled by the Taliban, by Al-Qaeda, and where these groups threatened to execute any vaccinators that came in to vaccinate for polio. So that's holding up the program right now. You also have problems in northern Nigeria, and I'm going to come back to that in a few minutes. And again, it's interesting how this is not at the level of the entire state, but of regions within states. And finally, in northern India, in the states of Uttar Pradesh and Bihar, these are huge states. These are basically, for all intents and purposes, are bigger than almost every most countries. And here the problems are a little more complicated. You have very high population density, very high growth in population, very poor sanitation, and you have kind of public government governance infrastructure that's rather weak. And so all these things combined that are creating problems there. So there are different problems in different places. The outbreak of polio that emerged in northern Nigeria in 2003, 2004 is very important because it's kind of like an experiment for the world that you had this epidemic of polio that was unleashed, and I think it went to about 20 different countries. I have a picture here of a t-shirt for the polio campaign. It says, "Kick polio out of Nigeria." Well, I don't think the intention was to actually literally kick the virus out of Nigeria, but that's what happened in late 2003, 2004. And what was causing that was statements made by religious leaders, allied to some extent to political leaders in states like Kano, that suspended vaccination because of claims that this the vaccine was a Western plot. That's the same kind of argument made today in Afghanistan. This is what the spread looked like. And what I think is curious is when you get this spread of polio, what happens to it? Now, notice that one of the places where polio goes is Botswana. Well, Botswana, as I'll show you in a minute, is a well-run country with very high immunization levels. So what is that polio case? What happens? Nothing. That one person has polio, it does not spread. Okay? And there's a case where successful governance is very important for, in this case, achieving global eradication. Whereas when polio spread into other places like Somalia, well, it's still there today. This table, which I know is hard to read, but what I'm doing here is making the connections between polio as it exists in certain countries and the spread. You have the very top, you have the countries that were polio endemic over this period, 2002 to 2005. And the countries listed in colored in red are the ones that are engaged in conflict in those years. Interestingly, the two countries that, according to this one measure of conflict, had no conflict, because issue about the measures, Egypt and Niger, they are actually no longer considered to be fully endemic by the WHO. If you look down the list there, you'll see how polio spread. Now, in some cases, you had cases from India that went, into Angola, but quite a lot of these were connected to Nigeria, either directly or indirectly. The important thing to note, if you look at the far right columns, is that there is a pretty good correlation. It's not perfect, but a pretty strong correlation between polio, where it became reestablished, basically. Maybe the WHO is not calling it endemic, but where cases still continue to turn up, and that's true, for example, in Somalia. Those countries tend to rank very high in the failed states index, meaning they have a small number. They also are countries that are very often colored in red. They actually do have conflict, and this is the real problem for polio. Even if you make success in contracting polio, if it emerges again, which it has done here, it's going to go back and create a problem in these states, these states. And just start pulling all these data together, what you see at the top is that in the countries where transmission was sustained, they tended to rank much higher in the failed states index, 28. And those states also were more likely to be involved in armed conflict. Okay, so the conflict measure I looked at before may not be very good in a general sense, but when you're looking at this subset of countries, it seems to be a little more powerful. Now, this failed states index, for a talk like this, sometimes it's better to think in broader terms, and the people who organize this have these color coding. It's a bit like what we used to do here for terrorist alerts. And you'll notice, by the way, that the U.S. is in this intermediate category, a little bit behind Portugal, and not in the highest category. Here's what polio looks like today. Basically, what you see is all the countries that are endemic or non-endemic are in one of the top two categories for a failed state. In terms of conflict, the situation is slightly more mixed, but probably, even if you look at a country like Niger, again, the conflict data I have shows that Niger is actually has not been engaged in conflict in this period, but there are conflict issues in Niger, so I think this question of definition the court mentioned is very important. And then in places like India, as I said, the problem really is not so much conflict. It's much more the basic epidemiological environment. Another one to focus on is guinea worm. I have 3 minutes. Okay, and this is a regional disease that the world has been trying to eradicate for even longer than polio. And the number of endemic countries has shrunk over time. Now, here if you look at these data, you'll see, again, all these countries are in the failed states category. Now, one of the things that has held up guinea worm eradication, and guinea worm, by the way, is an easy disease to eradicate compared to polio, a totally different problem, and polio has a lot of issues, and guinea worm certainly does not. But one of the things that's been holding up eradication of guinea worm has been the civil war in Sudan. And another reason for mentioning Sudan is it happened that the smallpox eradication coincided with a ceasefire in Sudan. And through most of Sudan's recent history, there has been conflict. But in that one small window of time when smallpox was eradicated, there was peace. Now, if you look at this table, though, it's not so clear how important conflict is. If you look in the right column and you look at the bottom, these are the countries that actually did get rid of guinea worm. And if you look, I've got the year in which they get rid of guinea worm and whether they were in conflict or not. And you'll see some countries were and some countries weren't. So it seems not to be a big problem. And then if you look at the top and you compare Sudan, where conflict is definitely a big issue, but look at Ghana. Ghana conflict is not the issue in northern Ghana, and yet guinea worm has been difficult to get rid of there. And the basic problem there has to do with the provision of clean water. And it comes down to something really quite simple. And that reminds us, again, that it's not just conflict. It's the notion of a failed state of a government being able to provide basic public goods, basic services. Now, there are two cases that are of global interest to us. On the one hand, it's eradication. So that's where you've got a disease that has threatened a large number of countries. And the success in getting rid of it depends on the weakest link, right? It's the country that's the least able, basically, to deliver for the world. It holds the whole world back. Well, the opposite problem is that you have the emergence of a new disease that no one's had before, but everyone's potentially vulnerable to. Okay? Now there, when you think about emerging infectious diseases, I think the case is even more complicated. For example, if you look at HIV, that probably emerged in southeastern Cameroon probably around the year 1920 or so, probably through a man eating bushmeat. Okay? Probably, that's where the speculation is. There are connections with development, and there may be connections there with failed states, but then you think of another disease like BSE, and I lived in Britain throughout that wonderful period. Now there, that's emerging in a country that has basically industrialized the rearing of livestock. So it's a very different kind of problem. And I think if you think about SARS, again, China, it's a different situation. These are some numbers I put together just for today on the number of confirmed cases of H5N1, human cases of H5N1. And what you see here, you have Nigeria, which is one of the more highly ranked failed states. But the problem is very strong in countries that don't rank so high in the failed states index. And it may be that for emerging infectious disease like a pandemic influenza, that the problem won't be at the extreme countries that are involved in conflict and are extremely failed, because these countries are not even able to develop to the point where this particular disease may well emerge. You basically need a lot of birds in contact with a lot of people, and you've got an ideal situation for that in a place like Indonesia, but not so much possibly in some other countries. So I think the case with the emerging infectious diseases is more complicated, but the general point I want to make is that global health depends not only what is done within a country, it depends very much on what's going on in other countries. And we need to think about global health policy, not just in terms of domestic policy, and not just in terms of defense, you know, preventing the pathogens from entering the country, but we need to think a lot more about offense. That's the whole nature of globalization. So we need to worry about where these diseases might emerge. We need to worry about where these diseases might be exterminated. Thank you.